From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Armistead Maupin is identified with San Francisco, where his Tales of the City novels are set. His new novel takes him to Hollywood. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about homophobia in Hollywood and why he doesn't believe in keeping secrets. We'll also be joined by Maupin's lover and business manager, Terry Anderson. They say Anita Bryant helped them out of the closet. Also today, the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. John Frohnmayer tells us how he was forced out because of his disagreements with the Bush administration over public funding of controversial art. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush campaigned in Ohio today, continuing to ride yesterday's better-than-expected economic news. Mr. Bush told crowds in Cleveland and Toledo that just as the economy is improving, so is his chance of re-election. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Columbus.
It's going to happen, Mr. Bush said today, after telling crowds at previous rallies that something is happening out there. Various polls released today don't back up his claims, however. For the most part, the only significant movement has been a post-debate shift to Ross Perot. But an upbeat president told a huge crowd in Toledo, the country's beginning to move. Don't do something to set it back, he said, appealing for votes. Mr. Bush traveled with two Hollywood heavies today, Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger, who told voters to consider Governor Clinton's record in Arkansas before casting their ballots. The Bush campaign released a new television ad today, a 30-second spot featuring a buzzard, a dead tree, and storm clouds, warning voters that Governor Clinton will do to the country what he did to Arkansas. The Clinton campaign responded with a fax entitled, "If at first you don't succeed, lie, lie again." I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Columbus.
Bill Clinton aimed for the votes of Perot supporters today, saying that the Texas billionaire's allegations of dirty tricks raised questions about whether he has the temperament to be president. He added, though, that he would like to have Perot's advice on the issues that he knows and cares about. Two polls released today showed the gap narrowing between Clinton and President Bush, but differed on how close they'd become. A CNN USA Today survey of likely voters showed Clinton at 40% and President Bush at 38%. ABC said its survey of likely voters had Clinton ahead with 42% to 35% for the president. The Los Angeles truck driver who was dragged from his rig and beaten during the L.A. riots has filed a claim against the city, seeking at least $10,000 in damages. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
Truck driver Reginald Denny is white, but his claim against the city is based on an allegation of racial discrimination. Denny was driving through South Central Los Angeles, a mostly black community, when he was attacked. His claim contends the Los Angeles Police Department neglects minority communities, and that if there had been a greater police presence in South Central, his beating would not have taken place. Reginald Denny's claim against the city is just one of nearly 1,800 riot-related claims that were filed this week to beat tomorrow's deadline. The claims are a necessary first step before the filing of a lawsuit. Attorneys for Los Angeles say that the city cannot be held liable for riot-related injuries, according to a court decision following the Watts riots in the 1960s. But Reginald Denny's attorney says that ruling does not apply to civil rights suits. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 16 points to close at 3,251. This is NPR. Russian President Boris Yeltsin cracked down on his political opponents today, outlawing a newly formed political group and ordering a hardline security force disbanded. Yeltsin said that he'd ban the New National Salvation Front, a mostly right-wing opposition group that's accused him of destroying the nation's economy. The Russian president called the group extremist and said it posed a great danger to the country. Yeltsin also ordered the disbanding of a special 5,000-member police force controlled by one of his opponents, the Speaker of the Russian legislature. As heavy fighting continues around the Liberian capital, relief workers are trying to penetrate the front line to rescue 300 orphans. Cindy Shiner of Africa News Service reports from Monrovia.
In Liberia, the town of Chocolate City has become a virtual prison for 300 orphans caught in the crossfire of war. The children, one quarter of them babies, have been stranded at an orphanage there for 6 days. Relief workers say there has been no orphanage staff to care for the children for a week, and soldiers have stolen their food. Liberia's rebel forces are notorious for recruiting children as young as 8 to fight. In the town of Banga, headquarters for rebel leader Charles Taylor, some school children have gone on a hunger strike to protest forced recruitment. Relief workers today made 2 attempts to rescue the orphans, but had to turn back because of heavy fighting around the orphanage. They will try again Thursday. 17 of the children have managed to escape from Chocolate City and are being housed with other orphans at Monrovia's former American school. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Monrovia.
There was more bad news for the nation's manufacturers today. The Commerce Department reported that orders for durable goods declined for the 3rd month in a row. Demand for costlier, long-lasting products ranging from airplanes to refrigerators fell by 0.4% in September, the same as a revised drop the month before. The report said that not only do manufacturers have fewer orders, they also have fewer unfilled orders to work on. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Armistead Maupin once wrote that being a gay humorist in the AIDS era is like being Henny Youngman at Auschwitz. Maupin is best known for his Tales of the City, a series of 6 novels set in San Francisco. Critic Walter Kendrick described Maupin as portraying a microcosm in which every sexual bent, homo, hetero, bi, trans, and undecided, coexists amid comprehensive love and respect. Now Maupin has completed his first novel since the series ended. It's called Maybe the Moon, and it brings us a new cast of characters and a change of venue. It's set in Hollywood and is told from the point of view of a 31-inch-tall actress who's trying to prove she can play more than freak roles. Her claim to fame is that she was the anonymous actress underneath the rubber suit playing the elf character in the 2nd most popular movie of all time. This novel was inspired by Maupin's late friend Tamara Dutrow, who wore the extraterrestrial costume in several scenes of E.T. I asked Maupin why he wanted to write about her and Hollywood.
Well, I felt that there was a fascinating parallel there between her life and the lives of a lot of people in Hollywood and around Hollywood who are required to remain invisible in order to support Hollywood's idea of what fantasy is. I'm speaking here of gays and lesbians quite specifically, but also African-Americans, Asians, Jews, anyone who's told that their lives, their shape, their presence is somehow or other not in keeping with the sort of white bread American fantasy machine. So my friend Tammy seemed to me the most extreme example of that. It was interesting to me during the last year when a lot of gays and lesbians were protesting Basic Instinct, and the argument was made that gays and lesbians are never seen in films unless they are objects of extreme ridicule or made to seem sinister, extremely scary. Well, little people have been saying this for years as well. When you think about it, the dwarves that you see in movies are always the objects of humor, buffoons, or they're scary little creatures that are made to seem extremely wicked. And that's what we do in this culture, essentially, with anyone who's different. We don't humanize them at all.
Now, there's a kind of funny a scene that's both like funny and makes you angry at the same time, in which this actor who's still in the closet because of his career is in a hotel with his lover, who's a writer and an activist, who's very out. And then the actor's agent shows up, and the writer has to kind of hide in another room and says, "God, this is like a Feydeau novel or something," you know.
Yeah. Especially because all 3 men are gay.
Right, right.
The agent is gay, the actor is gay, the writer is gay, but the gay actor has promised his agent that he won't have any homosexual relationships while he's making this movie, so he has to hide another gay man from another gay man. And this is simply my way of observing where the homophobia of Hollywood comes from. It's not, for the most part, generated by heterosexuals. It's generated by homosexuals in positions of power who are trying to keep the lid on, who say, this is the way you make money. You remain invisible. You shut up about it. I'm able to be out because I'm an agent. I'm a manager. I can do this. I can take my boyfriend to the restaurant. You can't do it. You're supposed to be a movie star, and movie stars are not supposed to be homosexual. So we have a system that perpetuates itself, and I don't see much movement in that direction. I mean, I think that's going to keep on happening.
I know that you feel that people who are gay should just be out. Is it a burden to you to keep somebody secret when they don't want to be out? Or when they feel that they can't be out for professional reasons?
It's more of an insult than a burden, because I feel that it reduces me to a kind of second-class citizen to even have to keep that secret for that friend. Yeah, it bothers me, and I generally tell people when it bothers me. And some of my friendships have ended because of that. I can think of certain actors in Hollywood where I've told them I was tired of waiting and I didn't think we could really be friends, because it does reduce you to a kind of second-class citizenship.
What's the difference between a secret and privacy?
Well, I think privacy has to do with what goes on in the bedroom, with really deep innermost secrets. I don't consider the fact that a person has a lifelong partner of the same sex to be an issue of privacy any more than I would consider it an issue of privacy to know that Robert Redford has a wife somewhere. I think we have a real dual standard when it comes to our discussion of homosexuality and our discussion of heterosexuality. The reigning way of operating has been to assume that any mention of homosexuality is an invasion of privacy. And I think until that changes, we're not going to lift the taboos on homosexuality. That's what plagues me about it.
But if you have a friend who feels that it's in their best interest to stay in the closet, can they trust you with their secret?
No, because I don't respect that secret. I don't have friends like that. My friends are all out of the closet.
Even all your friends in Hollywood?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, most of them are. In fact, all of them are. The people I'm really close to are people like David Hockney, Sir Ian McKellen. These are really some of my closest friends. Don Bacardi, who lives in Hollywood and was Christopher Isherwood's lover for many years. I don't know many actors for that very reason. Michael Kearns is a friend of mine. He's out of the closet. When I discover that someone's gay and closeted, I make an effort to convince them that this is what they should do, and sometimes they run screaming into the woods and I never see them again. I feel a real responsibility to put pressure on these people because nobody else is doing it. And I think it's time we started questioning these values. If homosexuality is officially going to remain the biggest taboo in our society, then I'm going to do everything I can to break that down. And that means putting individual pressure on people.
How do you do it? How do you try to convince people to come out?
Well, what I did with Ian McKellen was simply answer his questions, because he is a man of great conscience to begin with, and he asked me and my lover Terry if we thought he should come out of the closet, and we said, yeah, we think you should. You're famous enough. you're an extremely successful man. It would mean a lot to a lot of other people. We don't think it would hurt your career. And in fact, did not. He's making movies right now as we speak. And he was knighted by the Queen after he came out of the closet. But fundamentally, we told him we felt he'd be a happier person. We felt that his life would change, that he would feel truer to himself, that his art would improve, which everyone seems to think has. And we told him we felt he had a moral responsibility to do it.
Writer Armistead Maupin is my guest. His new novel is Maybe the Moon. After a short break, we'll be joined by Armistead's lover and business partner, Terry Anderson. This is Fresh Air. Terry Anderson is joining us, and Terry, just to give all this a context, you handle all the business relations,
right,
for Armistead. You're touring together on this book tour for,
right,
the new book, and you've been together for several
seven years. A few weeks ago, in fact.
So now let me get back to this Ian McKellen story. So, Armistead was telling us about,
yeah,
how you both convinced him to come out. tell me what you both told him about what to expect, because I'm sure he had concerns.
Well, you know, Ian, the argument is always that leading men and leading women can't come out of the closet. Ian was never a leading man. I mean, at least in the last several years of his career, he's not been. So he just felt like he was the logical person to do it, because he was in a position as the foremost actor of his generation, the foremost classical actor of his generation, to say, you know, yes, I'm gay. And it didn't even arise until we had these long discussions in San Francisco, and he went back to Great Britain and was on the radio with a homophobe arguing against a homophobic ordinance, not unlike the ones that are going on right now in Oregon and in Denver. And the homophobe was sort of saying nasty things about homosexuals, and Ian just simply said, as a gay man, everyone sort of dropped their teeth, and then when they recovered, he was out of the closet.
Terry, do you share Armistead's point of view that you would prefer not to keep people's secrets if you know they're in the closet?
We share our views on everything almost completely. Yes, we don't keep secrets. Don't ask me to keep a secret, because it's not my responsibility to do that. So when people say, don't, you know, keep my secret, I say, no, don't tell me.
Armistead, you're a little older than you are,
years,
Terry.
Yeah.
So you're of like slightly different generations in terms of kind of gay politics in America. Do you know what I mean? Because so much has happened in that 15-year gap in your age. So I imagine like your coming out stories are pretty different. And
you know, it's funny.
Because
yeah,
I'd imagine
things...
like the way it was seen like socially by friends and family would be pretty different because of that time change.
One of the things we have in common is that we consider ourselves the same gay age.
We really do. Yeah. This makes sense when you think about it now.
Armistead and I came out during 1976, 1977, the same period of time.
Anita Bryant brought us out at the same time.
I was 15 years younger. I was 16 years old when it happened. Armistead was, you know, older. But
a slow learner.
I came out of the closet very early, and I think we experienced a lot of the same. We both experienced pre-age sexuality, first of all, of being able to go out to bathhouses and to have sex with, you know, frankly, with me, with large numbers of other men, who it changed my experience and my views about life. And I think it formed my views in many ways, and I think the same thing happened with Armistead. So when we met in Atlanta 7 years ago, it was one of those things where we couldn't stop talking. All of our experiences were the same. Our politics were the same. I mean, we just really agreed about everything, and our experiences were very much the same around gay life and gay issues.
No, wait, Armistead, I know you have the honor of having gotten an award that Anita Bryant once
got. Yeah.
What's the award called?
The Freedom Leadership Award of the Freedoms Foundation at Valley Forge. We should have a drum and fife playing in the background while I say that. Yeah, I came from a very right-wing background in North Carolina. I worked for Jesse Helms, for heaven's sakes, when he was the executive vice president of WRAL Television about 25 years ago. But, you know, I think this is really interesting, this business of the fact that we came out over Anita Bryant. What happens that these homophobes create proud homosexuals? I think Pat Buchanan has done more this year for the gay rights movement than any single homosexual I can name.
Thank you, Pat.
Because he really did, he not only made a lot of homosexuals angry, he made a lot of heterosexuals angry. He made a lot of liberals see that this sort of hatred still exists in this country, because I think people needed convincing of that for a while.
As I'm sitting here talking to both of you, I'm wondering this. Since you both believe that you know, secrets are bad things, unhealthy things to have, how do you feel about being a kind of, quote, like celebrity couple in a way? Do you know what I mean? Like how?
Well,
because I'm sure this kind of thing comes. You know, it's not the first time it's come up that an interviewer has spoken
to
both
of you.
You
know, I don't have a thing. I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, we both have said, I think, at times in the past that it's wonderful to be able to say what we think about life and to have people listen to what we have to say, and to have the love that we feel for each other represent something and mean something to other people. It's wonderful. It gives meaning to our relationship. We're both on the same mission. And I don't think we suffer from the spotlight. I don't know. Do you, Terry?
No, I don't necessarily love it. I mean, Armistead's much better at being in the spotlight than I am. But I feel a responsibility. You know, I grew up in Marietta, Georgia, without any homosexuals around me, without knowing that there was any homosexuals around me. I had no, quote, role models. And I don't even think that's the most important thing. But I want to know that homosexuals are out there. And if Armistead and my talking about this can make it a little easier for some 13-year-old not to feel so weird and geeky about it, then I think it's something worth doing. Because, I mean, we all grew up feeling a little different and weird, I think, but homosexual kids especially have it tough. And there's no support from the family. If you grew up if you're black and you grew up black in a black family, you automatically have that support from the family members. If you are gay, you don't have any support. You just are out there on your own, and it's a tough thing to be.
You know, I've been back to Raleigh several times. Actually, Terry and I went back and marched.
It's your hometown.
Yeah, Raleigh's my hometown, and Terry and I marched in Raleigh's first gay pride parade about 4 years ago. And I signed books there, and I had people stand in my line, older people in their mid-50s that I knew when I was growing up, who, after I had signed their books, revealed their homosexuality to me. And frankly, all I could feel was enormous resentment. I thought, where the hell were you when I was 14 years old and terrified? Thanks a lot for telling me now. If I had known that my eighth grade teacher was a gay man, when I was suffering with my homosexuality, if he had pulled me aside and said, you're going to be all right, this is fine, don't worry about it, it's just another way of living, I would have been a much happier kid at the time. So I resent it. And I don't want the world to keep on being that way. And it depresses me to be almost 50 years old and to have been out of the closet publicly for almost 20 years and still hear that there are teenagers killing themselves over this issue.
Are your parents warm in-laws to each other?
Terry's parents are, well, my mother's no longer alive. My father's a rather hidebound conservative who has met with us in San Francisco, and on one occasion he actually weakened a little and said that Terry was the best thing that ever happened to me. I cling to that because he's still blind in a lot of ways. I think he's voting for Bush, for starters.
And second of all, his sister tells him that he says nasty things, his father says nasty things about my having HIV, about how he brought it on himself. So he's rather two-faced when you come right down to it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line, you know, and he's very friendly to my face. I don't necessarily believe him most of the time.
Terry's mother has been wonderfully accepting of the two of us. In the beginning, it was tough for her, I guess, largely because I'm about 5 years younger than she is, and I think that was part of what made it awkward for her. But now she sends, you know, cakes at Christmas, and she says love to Armistead, and we love you, Terry, and we love you, Armistead, too. And
now, has Armistead's kind of success and your success as a writer, I mean, you're known, you're a bestseller in England and the United States. Has that helped her be accepting of him, or is that not relevant? In a way, it shouldn't be relevant.
No,
I'm not sure
that it is relevant. I mean,
my mother's part of that great, vast middle class out there who might know who Danielle Steele is, but when it comes to books, that doesn't have much of an effect on them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you're kind of like empirically successful.
But on the other hand, she woke up to Terry's HIV status when I made a remark in Newsweek to the effect that how odd it was to live with someone who might be dead in 6 months. And that was the very first time where she really forced herself to look at the ramifications of HIV.
Even though I told her, like, the week I found out I was positive, I told her, it's been 6 years now, it didn't sink in until she saw it in print, you know. She sort of was in denial, I think. And I think some ways she still has been. I just got over a bout of pneumocystis about a month ago. And it was during that time even that I saw her coming around a bit more to the notion that I have a terminal illness and that I'm probably going to die from it. And that she's got to accept it. If I've got to accept it, she's got to accept it. But she's been able to deny it for a long time. But because of my illness and because they were calling almost every day to find out how I was doing, and I was really quite sick, that sort of slapped her back, braced her up a bit, and made her realize that there was something serious going on here.
And she's really come around.
She
has, in a wonderful way.
Yeah, I mean,
in fact, his whole family has.
Was the pneumocystis the first time that you had gotten an illness as a result of the HIV that really totally knocked you out?
Yeah. I've had minor things, you know, funguses here or there, nothing spectacular. This is the first real round of it. And it's the first official diagnosis of AIDS when you come down with pneumocystis. So I've been HIV positive until the last 6 weeks, and now I have AIDS. Not that there's that big a distinction, as we all know, but there is a semantic distinction, and it took me a little while to get used to the notion of it. After 6 years of dealing with HIV, you know.
Do you feel like you're making any big changes in your life now that you've been diagnosed with AIDS?
No, I think, Terry, the changes came very slowly over a period of years of knowing I was positive. You know, I think that makes you think about, You know, when you just have swollen glands, for instance, you wonder what the hell's going on with your body, you know? And so I think I sort of dealt with all that. I don't fear dying. I fear being sick. I don't want to have to go through being really sick like a lot of people have to do. But I don't worry about dying. I sort of made my peace with that. You know, I don't have any concern about it anymore. And I used to. But it took me confronting HIV to sort of get beyond it and get through it. So I don't really don't. It's not been that traumatic. I mean, the times that was traumatic was when it was frustrating that I couldn't feel better. You know, it was work I wanted to do on the new book, or maybe the moon, getting it out and getting it promoted and that sort of stuff. And I couldn't participate as fully as I'd like to have because I was laying in the bed sick with a 103-degree fever, you know.
Armistead, do you feel that this is something you've made your peace with too?
Not entirely, because as Terry and I have discussed, he knows he's going to have me to the end of his life, but I don't know that about him. So there's this big, gray, amorphous area that's in the back of my mind that's labeled after Terry, and I don't know what that is yet. And I find myself preparing for it and then getting angry with myself for preparing for it, because I want to live in the moment and I want to be, you know, completely there for Terry and for both of us, really, not for him, but for us, for our relationship all the time. So I can't say that I have. There were a couple of times, once last year in New Zealand, where Terry and I had a sort of traumatic legal hassle, I guess is the best way to describe it, that threw me off balance. And because of it, I spent an evening sort of sobbing in Terry's arms, and I realized it wasn't about that issue at all. It was really about him, about simply mourning us before I'd lost him. And I'm not really able to do that very much. I don't want to do it very much. I know that time will come, and I'll have to deal with it when it happens. But
you know, grieving, as we know, when someone dies is a very important part of the healing process. But I think you also have to remember grieving can take a lot of different forms. I mean, I feel like I have in some ways grieved the loss of my former self, in the sense that up until 6 years ago, I viewed myself as a healthy young man. And then I found out that I had HIV and essentially had a death sentence, you know, handed to me in some ways. I mean, I like to believe that, you know, we're all going to survive this and that whole thing. I know a lot of people who thought they were going to survive it who are dead now. So I think I'm kind of realistic about the possibilities that I'm going to die from HIV-related illness in some stage in the future. There was a thing for me of having to sort of sort through the change of how I view myself from the formerly very healthy, strapping young man to someone who was more fragile with their health than that.
Was it a hard decision, you know, deciding to come on the tour, because it was just a few weeks ago that you had the pneumocystis? And I've looked at your tour schedule. You're in a lot of cities,
it was hard
a different
for me.
One every day.
20 cities, yeah.
Yeah.
I wondered whether I should put my foot down about it, because Terry is a real worker. I mean, nothing makes him happier than working this tour. His preparation for this tour, he's never stopped. You know, he was in there every morning at 6 o'clock in front of his word processor setting it up. He couldn't wait to do this, and I was really concerned whether or not he himself would have the judgment to say, no, I'm too weak for this. But his energy's been great. He's been very healthy on the road, actually, I think, precisely because we are working.
Yeah, well, because I also plan the tour, I put a little extra time in. We spend 2 days in a city instead of one in some cases, so we've got a chance to sort of relax a bit. You know, we're not just rushing all the time. That was built in from the beginning for this very reason. Mm-hmm. But I gave my doctor, it was funny, I was sick, and I gave my doctor a deadline. I said, I've got to be well by the 1st of October so I can go on this tour.
He did.
He was
well by the 1st of October.
So.
Well, I wish you both the best, and I want to thank you a whole lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you. Armistead Maupin and Terry Anderson. Armistead Maupin has a new novel called Maybe the Moon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, art, blasphemy, and the First Amendment. We talk with John Frohnmayer, the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. He was forced out because of his disagreements with the Bush administration over public funding of controversial art. John Frohnmayer coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton took his campaign to Jackson, Mississippi today, where he called on Reagan Democrats to come home to what he called a new Democratic Party. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In Jackson, Mississippi, Clinton made a blistering attack against the president, trying to turn the attacks the Republicans have made about trust to his advantage. Clinton quoted an editorial that called Bush's political ads worse than a lie.
The campaign that my opponent has run has done no honor to the American political process. I thought it was bad 4 years ago, but the ads that he's running now on agriculture, on taxes, on jobs, on defense, you name it, he just makes it up.
Mississippi is one of the most solid Republican states of the Old South, with two Republican senators and a Republican governor. Although some polls show that Clinton is within striking distance of George Bush here, the campaign admits it has little chance to win the state. In Jackson, I'm Mara Liasson.
Campaigning today in Ohio, President Bush once again predicted victory next week and said the Democratic ticket feels it slipping away. Campaigning today before large rallies, and with movie actor Bruce Willis at his side, Mr. Bush said the nation likes a fighter. Appearing on ABC this morning, the president said if Congress had found that he had done anything illegal in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal, in his words, it would have had him up there and burned him good. He called investigations into Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's use of U.S. aid for weapons pure partisan politics. In Dallas, that city's police chief is denying a published report that an associate of Ross Perot had asked him to conduct a sting operation against a GOP campaign official. NPR's John Burnett reports.
In a copyright story published today, the Dallas Morning News quoted Police Chief Bill Rathburn as saying that a security aide to Ross Perot had clearly laid out an undercover action targeting Jim Oberwetter, the president's re-election chairman in Texas. The report said that former FBI agent James Ciano, a paid security consultant for Perot, offered his employers equipment, airplanes, and financing for use in a possible operation. At a press conference today, Rathburn said the report was essentially correct, but he denied that he had discussed any type of operation. He said he suggested that Ciano and Perot contact the FBI, which they did. Perot acknowledged that his associate did contact the police, but he also denied that money, airplanes, or equipment were discussed. The FBI, acting on Perot's suspicions, did conduct an unsuccessful sting operation against Oberwetter this August. Perot believed the Republicans were behind a plot to wiretap his office phones. In Denver, I'm John Burnett.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 15 points to close at 3,251.40 on volume of more than 203 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. The government says that orders for big-ticket durable goods were down last month by 0.4%. It was the third month in a row that durable goods orders moved down. Unfilled durable goods orders have fallen for more than 1 year now and are at their lowest point in nearly 4 years. The government says that personal income moved up 0.7% last month for the biggest increase in 9 months. The Commerce Department says consumers' spending and savings were also up. Consumer spending makes up 2/3 of the nation's economic activity. Arab-Israeli peace talks in Washington have recessed until November 9th, after the U.S. presidential election. There has not been much progress to report from the latest round of meetings, but little was expected. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Uncertainty about the outcome of the U.S. elections created a pause in the peace process. During the last week, Syrian and Israeli negotiators did continue working on a joint statement of principles to guide future talks, but did not finalize it. In the latest negotiations, Israeli delegates did use the word withdrawal for the first time in connection with the Golan Heights, but linked it to a full peace treaty with Syria. Meanwhile, Israeli and Palestinian delegates explored their differences in informal working groups, but reached no official agreements. On the positive side, the Israeli-Lebanese talks continued despite fierce attacks and counterattacks between Israeli and Hezbollah forces along the Israeli-Lebanese border. And many analysts think the negotiations will get moving again after the U.S. elections. If there is no progress, they warn, the peace process could founder. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Also in Washington, the Bush administration has announced plans to upgrade F-16 fighter jets owned by four other nations and built by General Dynamics. The contract comes to $1.85 billion for General Dynamics. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Republican Party platform condemns the use of public funds to subsidize, quote, obscenity and blasphemy masquerading as art. That point of view is one of the reasons John Frohnmayer is no longer the head of the National Endowment for the Arts. He couldn't support the Bush administration's sanctions against public funding of controversial art, and he was forced out last spring. He was appointed head of the agency in 1989. During his tenure, he was caught in the middle between the religious right and the arts community. The right thought he didn't do enough to crack down on homoerotic and sexually explicit art. The arts community accused him of vetoing grants to controversial artists, while adding an anti-obscenity pledge, which artists accepting money had to sign. This was in compliance with the Helms Amendment, which outlawed federal funding of obscene art. The anti-obscenity clause recently was found unconstitutional. After Frohnmayer left the NEA, he became more outspoken on First Amendment issues. I asked him if he left the NEA feeling more strongly about the First Amendment than when he started.
I did. I had been a First Amendment lawyer. About 20% of my practice in Portland had been with television and newspaper interests. But it became a very different First Amendment, sort of an existential awakening, I suppose, when I realized that I had the power in my job to really affect people's speech and the amount of freedom that they had. And so while I was a First Amendment moderate when I came in, I really left as a First Amendment radical, feeling that it was the keystone of what makes our country free.
Are there decisions you made as a First Amendment moderate that you're now sorry you made as a First Amendment radical?
Well, I think that what I did, I really did the best I could with the information and the position that I was in on each of those decisions. But all of us look back at what we have done in the past and think of ways we could have done it better. I think that's part of the human condition, and it's also part of what inspires us to do better the next time.
Is there any one thing, though, that you wish you could do differently than you did when you were there?
I really wouldn't pinpoint anything except to say that I am writing a book about this, and that there will be, I mean, I do intend in that book to be as honest as I can about the decisions that I made.
Now, you left the NEA shortly after Pat Buchanan, during his primary campaign, called the NEA the upholstered playpen of the arts and crafts auxiliary of the Eastern liberal establishment, and he attacked the NEA for funding filthy and blasphemous art. Now, do you think you were asked to leave in response to that particular attack?
Yes, I do. It was specifically mentioned on my exit interview.
With Sam Skinner?
Yeah.
He was the chief of staff who, as you put it, handed you your hat. Can you tell us something? What happened at that meeting when he...
Well, basically, Sam called me in. He and I had never met. It wasn't much of a secret to me what the meeting was going to be about, although he didn't announce it when he said he needed to see me right away. And then he said, I understand from the president that you're intending to leave, and we danced around that for a while. I told him that I wanted to stay until I got some projects completed and that I had talked to the president about that, and it was fine with the president. And the crux of it was, he said, I want you to announce your resignation tomorrow. And then basically he said that Pat Buchanan had started these attacks and that I didn't want to be the target of that bully for the rest of the primary campaign season. Of course, as far as I was concerned, Pat Buchanan was only the latest in a series of of arts terrorists that had been on the case of the endowment ever since I had been there.
Did you consider asking Skinner to fire you instead of asking you to leave, so everything would be really up front and it would be really clear what was happening?
Well, I don't think there was any question about what happened. It was it was a firing.
Right. Now, I had read, and you can tell me if this is true, that John Sununu, the former chief of staff, had tried to get rid of you earlier in the fall of 1991.
There is no, there wasn't any mystery about Sununu's position either. I don't know whether he had taken steps to try to get rid of me. Certainly there were press reports of that sort of thing. But I think that, both Sununu and Skinner were reflective of the administration's failure or inability to recognize the value of controversy in our society.
Did you expect the National Endowment for the Arts to be a political football when you accepted the position as its head?
It was at the time that I accepted the position. What I didn't expect was for it to continue with as much scrutiny and as much intensity for the entire time that I was there.
The NEA is supposed to be insulated from political concerns. Why isn't it?
Well, I suppose that the surprising thing is that it has been so insulated over the first 25 years of its existence. It's really only in the last 3 years or so that it has become such a political football, and I think that's so for two reasons. On the one hand, those who so fiercely and publicly and fearlessly defended it on the basis of the necessity, not just for the arts, but for our whole society, that all voices be heard. Those voices have really been quelled over the last 3 years, and you can see that in the kinds of statements that appeared on the House and Senate floor in 1989, as opposed to those in 1991 or 1992. And the other side of it is that the fundamentalist right, the radical right, if you will, is far better organized now than it has ever been before, and it has pointed toward this issue as some way to continue to replenish their coffers since the specter of international communism has vanished.
Is there something that isn't working within the system? I mean, that thing that is supposed to keep the NEA insulated from politics, obviously it's not working that way. Is there something within that mechanism that's going wrong?
There's nothing wrong with the mechanism. There's something wrong with the individual courage of the people that are buckling under to this political, cultural terrorism. It seems to me that one of the things that our whole system has succumbed to is the politics of blame as opposed to the politics of responsibility. And it seems to me that it's not threatening, really, to the American scene to allow culture to be free. What's threatening to the American scene is the kind of narrow thinking and intolerance and misinformation that has marked the attacks on the NEA. It seems to me that that's a much greater threat to America than anything that the Arts Endowment has ever funded or ever will fund.
My guest is John Frohnmayer, and he was the chair of the NEA from 1989 until last April when he was forced out by the Bush administration. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Frohnmayer, the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. You had worked for the Bush campaign in 1988. Do you think that had to do with why you were appointed? And did the Bush administration expect political loyalty from you?
A hard question. I really had didn't have a lot of association with the Bush campaign in 1988. I can't really speculate about why I was appointed, except I do believe that I had the qualifications to hold the job. In terms of political loyalty, it seems to me that that makes sense only in the face of a program. And what I found after I joined the Bush administration was that they had no program for the arts other than to be non-controversial, and that, in fact, is no program at all.
Were you advised about what the White House expected of you?
Not really. The whole indoctrination was pretty minimal.
What did it consist of?
Well, there were some sessions at the White House for new appointees that talked about ethics and talked about not lobbying but educating Congress to points of view, that talked about open door policies of both the president and John Sununu and things like that. And those were helpful, but they really didn't amount to sitting down with either the president or the chief of staff, or for that matter anybody else, and talking through the goals of the arts policy. And so the goals of the arts policy were really my goals, as I had articulated them in my interviews and as I continued to articulate them in my confirmation message and thereafter. And seemingly that was fine with the administration, but again, all they wanted, I don't think they really cared whether I accomplished those goals or not. What they cared was that we not pop up on their radar screens as something that they had to deal with in terms of quelling a controversy.
Why were they afraid of controversy? Because it might create fires for them that they'd have to put out? Did it have to do with the arts, or did it just have to do with not wanting controversy?
Well, I think it had to do at its root with what I consider to be an unnatural and unnecessary and really quite unfortunate inclination of this administration to kowtow to the demands of the radical right.
It's been reported that John Sununu, who was then White House Chief of Staff, and William Kristol, who is Dan Quayle's Chief of Staff, wanted you to draw up a blacklist of artist troublemakers. Is that true?
I do write about that in my book, and I'd rather not answer it at this point, but I think I'll leave it at that.
When you left the NEA, you said that you thought your successor would be a decency czar. Anne Radice has been serving as the interim head of the NEA. Do you think she's been serving as a decency czar?
I can't answer that question. The only thing that I know is that immediately after she was empowered, she vetoed two grants on the basis of their sexual content, apparently. It was apparent to me that she was acting on orders from the White House to go in and take charge and show how tough she was. I think that that's a poor way to run a railroad, frankly. It seems to me that artistic excellence and artistic merit are the only way that one can really justify the endowment's existence. And if you start giving grants on bases other than that, then the whole endowment is compromised.
She was appointed as your deputy during your tenure at the NEA. Did you ever feel that she was there to keep watch over you or to report back to the Bush administration?
Well, I definitely felt that.
What gave you that feeling?
Well, it was clear to me that she was 100% political, and in fact, she said as much. And I do know that she had conversations with people in the White House about what was going on in the endowment, and I knew from various statements of people that she had talked to outside the White House that there were really two agendas going on, my agenda for the endowment and her desire to be politically responsible to the White House.
What do you think she was reporting back?
I really can't speculate on that.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the religious right, which pressured the Bush administration to crack down on the NEA. Christianity Today, the publication, reported in June of 1990 that the National Association of Evangelicals tried to work with you to fashion mutually acceptable solutions. What was that like?
Well, it was short-lived, unfortunately. I talked to the evangelical leaders at the White House, actually, at one point. And then we did talk with some of their leadership, but I think that their expectation about and I'm not sure entirely what their expectations were. We're not very realistic if one believes in the First Amendment. It's curious to me, actually, that the First Amendment, which protects religion, is also the First Amendment which protects speech, and particularly speech which may be dissident or may be unpopular. And many of the religious groups that were hard after the endowment seem to care very little about the freedom of speech of those people with whom they happen to disagree.
You've indicated that the mainstream churches were unfortunately absent from the debate about the arts. What would you have liked to hear from mainstream churches?
Something. Almost anything. I think that it's highly unfortunate that the fundamentalists got to set the agenda on this whole issue. What they claimed to be blasphemous was widely accepted to be so by people of goodwill in churches around the country and by members of Congress and members of the administration. And let me give you an example. One of the pieces that seemed to cause the most distress on the part of Reverend Wildman was a piece that he took out of context from a large collage by David Wanorowicz. And Wildman took a little image of Jesus with a crown of thorns and a needle in his arm out of that larger collage and sent that image to everybody in Congress, and I don't know who all else, and said, "This is blasphemous." Well, that image, if you look at it, is Christ with a needle in his arm, but the arms are down. They aren't on the needle. And it seems to me that one could, in traditional Christian theology, say that's an image of Christ taking on the sins of the world. That's a statement that I would have hoped would have come from mainline Christian churches. And instead, there was nothing.
Now, you were a theological student for a while, and you have your master's degree in Christian ethics. Did any of the art that you were passing judgment on pose religious problems to you, and did you think of any of it as blasphemous? Were you offended on religious grounds?
No. To me, religion sets one free. Religion enables one to think broadly and to know that one is unconditionally loved. Theology is not something which is a negative force in my life. And I guess that that's my concern about much of the fundamentalist opposition. It just seemed to be so hateful and so narrow and so sort of oppressive. And that's not the theology which I follow, nor do I believe it to be the theology or the message of Christianity.
John Frohnmayer is the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, a week from today, the election will be over. What do you have on the election today?
Mara Liasson and Elizabeth Arnold are traveling with Clinton and Bush, respectively, and they will tell us what they're finding. We have a conversation with Kathleen Hall Jamieson of the Annenberg School in Philadelphia about campaigns and television and the TV talk show campaign. We're talking about some issues. Deadbeat Dads is one. We're talking about the Florida economy, and we're talking to some voters and asking them what were the factors that went into their decision, if in fact they've made one.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Frohnmayer. He was the chair of the NEA from 1989 until last April when he was forced out by the Bush administration. One of your most controversial actions while you were the chair of the NEA was your vetoing of the grants to four artists who have since become known as the NEA Four: Holly Hughes, Karen Finley, Tim Miller, and John Fleck. Looking back on that now, and that happened in 1990, how do you feel about that decision? It was widely interpreted as those grants were vetoed because of sexual content. A couple of the artists were gay. Several of the performances had to do with matters pertaining to gender and sexuality and sexual preference.
Well, I would say simply two things about that. One, it's in litigation, and that constrains me from talking about it to any great extent. But secondly, keep in mind that the National Council on the Arts differed from the panel The panel recommended 18 grants. The National Council recommended 14 grants. And the National Council is not only a larger body, but a more distinguished body. And so I was faced with conflicting recommendations. Granted, I did not grant those grants, and so they were not approved, but I'm not sure I agree with the word veto. That suggests that there was some right.
I'd like for you to share your impressions of how the arts community reacted to you while you were the head of the NEA, and if you were seen as really being in the middle with the religious right on the one hand and artists making controversial art on the other. What's your critique of how the artists making controversial art and the exhibitors showing that art, what's your critique of how they handled you politically?
Well, I don't have any recriminations to make in that regard. I think everyone views the world out of his or her peculiar circumstances. And with the artist, particularly the individual artist, it is a very tender and sometimes very lonely and precarious existence. In that sense, when an artist is attacked, you aren't just attacking the art, you're attacking the whole life of the person who is making that art. Having said that, I think that the arts world is incredibly naive in terms of the fact that we do live in a political world, and in fact many artists are making art which is very political, and to not expect to get roughed up in the hurly-burly of political or of politics is unrealistic. On the other hand, and this is what makes this issue so complicated, one really hopes that we as a society are strong enough and confident enough to be able to let the artist have that freedom of imagination and have that ability to criticize the society, because in so doing, the artists help us work through the most difficult issues that we as a society face. And they also help us to build community, because it is that dialogue, that intellectual assembly that artists help us to encounter that leads us through these difficult issues and hopefully to at least a minimal consensus that will allow us as a society to not splinter apart.
John Frohnmayer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Frohnmayer is the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. Frohnmayer will discuss art and the First Amendment this Friday and Saturday at a conference in Minneapolis, co-sponsored by the Midwest Center for Arts, Entertainment, and the Law and Hamline University School of Law. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about politics and the state of the Republican Party with Lynn Nofziger, a longtime aide to Ronald Reagan, who also worked in the Nixon administration. He has a new political memoir. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.